This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. People in Scotland will vote next week on whether to become independent from the United Kingdom, and tension is rising. Here's Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond.
Scotland will vote yes next Thursday. And they'll vote yes because last-minute cobbled-up promises from the No campaign, which unravel at the slightest scrutiny, will not fool anyone in this country, and neither will the blatant bullying and intimidation of the Westminster government.
Oh yeah, well, here's what Westminster has to say, Prime Minister David Cameron.
I care hugely about this extraordinary country, this United Kingdom that we've built together. And that's what I want to talk about today. Because I would be heartbroken if this family of nations that we've put together and that we've done such amazing things together, if this family of nations was torn apart.
As this referendum approaches, many are examining the long legacy of the British Empire. One UNC scholar has studied the impact of early globalization on marginalized Scottish communities and the pressures that led to mass emigration from Scotland. It was an exodus that created a large settlement of Gaelic-speaking Highlanders in the Cape Fear region of North Carolina. Michael Newton works in the Digital Innovation Lab at UNC Chapel Hill, and he joins us now. Michael Newton, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you.
Thank you.
So what do you think is behind all of this, a significant vote coming up? Why this moment in history, do you think?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons, but certainly one of them is kind of repeating what Alex Salmond just said there. There was a sense of a social compact that was very strong after the Second World War, that there was a commonwealth, a sense of united purpose. And part of that was the result of things like wars. They always unify people. Also, the sense of a state that shared resources in an attempt to be equitable manner with other people. But really, all of that has been dismantled over the last 35 years, particularly starting with Margaret Thatcher, who, of course, is often compared to Reagan in the U.S. So there's a sense of kind of a lack of common purpose anymore because that social state has been dismantled. And also, the British Empire is no more. And Scots, I think, are much further along the road of realizing what that empire was about, who it served, and seeing that as long gone and dead, whereas English unionists tend to still be in this miasma of the imperial age.
Well, tell us more about this, because David Cameron uses what I think is the fraught phrase, family of nations. Now, the nation part is the thing that's stitched together by this social compact, a way of helping each other socially through programs that can bring you together. Family suggests a cultural bond, a kind of Englishness, and that has been in contention forever between these countries.
Yes, and I think that's a very key observation, that when you listen to news media, especially when it emanates from England, the term British is used as an extension of Englishness. That, you know, what do we mean by British? Well, usually we're talking about the English language, we're talking about English heritage, we're talking about a way of projecting this imperial ideology, which has England at its center and Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland are always very marginal and second rate, really. So, and not only that, not only has it been a highly centralized state, but over the last number of decades, arguably, London has had a greater and greater share of the resources, which are supposedly, you know, the UK. So and this idea of the family as a metaphor is very interesting because for many, many years, people in Scotland have likened the relationship to an abusing spouse who one of the partners abuses the other. The other is too afraid or too dependent to leave the relationship. And what more and more Scots are waking up to is the fact that actually they have all the resources that they need and know-how to do it better on their own. And so why stay in an abusive relationship when you're better off without it?
So we should now focus a little bit on Scotland itself and try to understand more about it. Your work focuses mostly on Gaelic-speaking Highlanders. So who are they?
Yes. So Scotland itself is complicated because it consists of more than one ethnic group. So people tend to identify with this kind of stereotype of a Scot wearing, you know, often kilts and tartan and playing the bagpipes and so on. And this is a stereotype, really, that emerges in the early 19th century by lowlanders appropriating the symbols of Highlanders. So for well over 1,000 years, there's been a pretty sharp divide between the people in the Highlands, who were the old Scots, the old Gaels, and the people in the Lowlands, who are really an extension of Anglo-Normans who settled in the Lowlands and over several generations took the reins of power for themselves and became more and more aligned with the interests of Anglophones in England, and who came to see the Scottish Highlanders as this kind of inferior race that was backwards, that had to be brought into their way of doing things and their culture for their own good. So there's a kind of structural ideology there, which is very familiar to us in the U.S. because those structures of empire are exactly what was rebuilt in the colonization of North America to justify the kinds of inequalities and exploitations that happened here. So ideologies of empire are inherently about inequality. And so it's no surprise that we can see structural parallels between the domination of Celtic peoples in the British Isles and the domination of native peoples on this continent.
The wild people who had to be tamed by the good English-speaking Christians who came over here to make their lives better.
Exactly.
That's the theory, and you hide behind that theory, and you can commit any number of atrocities in the name of it, and we did that as well. So now we've got this going on, but those Highlanders did find their way to this very colony, and many of them to the North Carolina colony, the Carolinas, right?
Yes, and the background context there, again, is the colonization carried out by the British Empire. In the 1730s, there was a governor of North Carolina who was a Lowland Scot who was trying to, of course, it was his job to settle the new colony with people who would be loyal to the crown. And, of course, in those times, what this meant was being Protestant. So he turned his focus to Scotland, which is where he was from, and word got out eventually to these people in the part of the Lowlands in the southwest, so the closest part to the southwest of the Highlands, which is the closest part to the Lowlands. They got word that there was this desire to bring migrants over. And at this time, there was a kind of squeeze on the middle class that was beginning to be felt. And so these middle class people who were called taxmen, people who held a tack, which was a sort of mortgage or lease for a bit of property, they realized that they were going to be squeezed out by these processes of globalization, as we would now call it.
Well, I'm going to stop you there. So what was happening, and why was a middle class in Scotland being squeezed by globalization and colonialism?
Well, just like nowadays, the people at the top want to siphon off as much as possible for themselves, and they want to get rid of the layers that are extracting parts of the profits. So they saw the taxmen, the people in the middle who were actually running their estates and doing a lot of the administrative supervisory sort of work, as a middle class that was taking profits for themselves, and that they could make more efficient profit for themselves by getting rid of the taxmen. Now, the taxmen were the people who were good at administration, who tended to be bilingual, who had a greater picture of what was going on in the British Empire. And so these folks saw an opportunity for saving themselves socially and economically by emigrating. And when they did, they brought quite a number of their dependents with them.
So now this sets up an interesting dynamic when they get here. You talked about them as educated and bilingual. They spoke Gaelic and English. And they came here with some wealth and some skill, but they brought with them people who maybe spoke only Gaelic and who had fewer skills, right?
That's correct. And of course, the 1730s is when the roots of the colony are sown. And over the next three or four generations, up until the beginning of the American Revolution, more and more people came over in a process that's often called chain migration. So they start writing letters back to the relations in Argyll saying, you know, we're doing well. We're not living under tyrannical landlords anymore. We have these freedoms and we're not going to be poor. You should come and save yourselves. So a very large exodus began in the 1760s and sustained itself up till the time of the revolution, 1775, 76.
Were there tensions here between those bilingual, upwardly mobile Scots and those who weren't? Gaelic speakers only?
Well, I can certainly say in North American colonies there were, because some of the taxmen wanted to kind of create their own fiefdoms when they came to North America and sort of exploit the people who were below them. I'm not going to claim that this was necessarily the case in all the taxmen who came to North Carolina, but there are certainly cases of taxmen who wanted to create, kind of recreate a feudal order in North America. But this didn't last too long, because once the people below them became more aware of what their opportunities were and that this was not the accepted goal of colonization, they would leave.
How did the Cape Fear become the home to the largest settlement, as I understand, of Gaelic-speaker Highlanders outside of Scotland?
Well, that was the case into the early 1800s. So again, we have this chain migration going on, where you have one group or one family, one community coming, and they write back to their relations, and they come along as well. And of course, not only that, but they're having children while they're here, and they're doing well enough to buy more land and settle more relations. So over time, this becomes a very large colony and settlement community of Gaelic speakers. Now, over time, after the Revolution, migration from Scotland was redirected to what we now call British North America. And then also people from the Cape Fear started moving to other places, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee,
Texas. How about the mountains of western North Carolina, where we see other a smaller population, do we?
Well, those weren't Highlanders. Those were largely Scots-Irish and Lowlanders who, again, looked on the Highlanders as the sort of wild, savage folk who they had very little in common with. There was one outlying family of Macraes who settled on what's now Grandfather Mountain. But they were a late settlement, and they were an outlier and very unrepresentative of the other people there. And in fact, I found a newspaper report from the early 1900s talking about them in kind of odd tones. Isn't it strange? There's this guy playing the bagpipes up in the mountain where nobody else is doing this.
What about the Gaelic language? How did that fare and survive migration?
Well, it did survive 2, 3, 4 generations sometimes. It depended on the particular community. We know that it survived into the early 20th century. I found accounts in North Carolina newspapers talking about, you know, so-and-so in the 1920s, 30s, who was a Gaelic speaker who died. But given that people were migrating from Scotland directly from the Highlands to North Carolina into about 1840, that's basically the lifetime of the last migrations. But certainly the formal institutions in the U.S. were discouraging any language but English. So when you went into a school, when you went for government services to, you know, to vote, to pay your taxes, of course they expected you to speak English. So this had a very negative effect. And not only that, I think there were negative associations with Gaelic because there were so many Highlanders who fought as loyalists during the Revolution. And then during the Civil War, or in the aftermath of the Civil War, people were sort of people were kind of forced to assimilate into this kind of notion of an Anglo-Saxon, a manifest destiny America that had a single identity. And of course, this became something of a crisis to so-called nativists in the 1770s into the First World War, when you had migration from Eastern Europe opening up for the first time. There was a greater demand for assimilation into this kind of Anglophone model.
We're talking about migration, Scottish migration to North Carolina today on The State of Things. Michael Newton is at UNC. He studies such things. What about that in terms of loyalty? When the Revolutionary War broke out, where were the Scots who were here on the war, on independence?
Well, it's estimated that there was about a breaking of thirds. The people who had been here the longest, who knew the most about, you know, the socioeconomic situation and politics, many of whom had become bilingual and were involved in state government or at least local government, tended to side toward the rebels. About a third of the people, and these are mostly people who were recent arrivals who spoke only Gaelic, who had remembered very with great lamentation the punishment they had after Culloden in the Highlands, were afraid to rebel. They'd taken oaths of allegiance, and they decided that the safest thing to do would be to fight for the crown. Remember, the British Empire is huge at this point and virtually unstoppable. About a third said, let's run away, like the scene in Monty Python. And so they went into hiding into the swamps and into the forests and tried to avoid getting caught up in the conflict.
That's kind of what we tell ourselves about the general breakdown in terms of the war. About a third were in favor, a third loyalist, and a third were ambivalent. Not much scholarship on Scottish immigrant communities. Why did you take this up?
Well, I kind of fell in love with this language and this literature and tradition and culture when I was in college and decided to go find out more for myself. And I went to Scotland and I lived there for 7.5 years. And I got a PhD in Celtic studies in Edinburgh. And when I came back, I kind of felt like I had to justify why was I going in this direction. And I started doing research and looking for sources about Gaelic speakers, Gaelic literature in North America, and discovered that this was a virtually untapped field, that there was quite a lot to say about it. And I've done a lot of work, but I'll say there's still quite a lot of interesting work to do on this very neglected aspect of the multicultural, multilingual background of what we now call the United States.
You are not a Scot, and yet you speak Gaelic at home, I understand.
Yes, I speak Gaelic exclusively to my daughter. She's only about 1.75 years, but she has a mixture of Gaelic and English, and she understands what I say when I speak in Gaelic, and she talks back in Gaelic, so far not rudely.
That sounds great. Michael, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Newton is a scholar from Chapel Hill. He's going to give a talk at UNC next Monday. It is called From Highlanders to Tar Heels, Scottish Gaelic Immigrant Communities in North Carolina. You can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, is the news director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.